Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Now, on today's instalment, we mull over the notion of new frontiers, be it a venue for architectural novelty in the north of England, the advent of outdoor lighting, or what to watch out for in the menswear industry this summer. First up, we stop in at the Royal Institute of British Architects' charming new berth in the north of England, a long overdue investment outside the design-spoilt UK capital.
I think the north is more than just a direction, it's an identity. And I think that with RIBA North, what we're doing is we're recognising that architects in the north are operating in a different context to other parts of the country.
Next, to the Fortezza di Basso in Florence for a snippet of wisdom from the menswear buyers, stocking up their shops and setting their sights on spring-summer 2018.
We changed a little bit the way we buy. Before it was more focused on the product, now we're trying to mix the product, the storytelling, and also the outfit.
Finally, we sit down with the illuminating CEO of Italian design firm Floss for an insight into how the lighting industry is moving beyond its usual indoor remit. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Now, the Royal Institute of British Architects has long had its headquarters in a gorgeous, purpose-built perch on 66 Portland Place in London. But now the organisation is opening a second spot in Liverpool in the northwest of England. Set on the city's waterfront in the recently completed boxy Broadway Mallion-designed Man Island buildings, the spot is in good company alongside the city's famous Three Graces, the Liver building, the Cunard building and the Port of Liverpool building. Monocle's Holly Fisher went along to find out why Reba decided to head north and why Liverpool is the perfect place to expand to.
Liverpool, famous for its football club, its docks and of course its biggest cultural export, the Beatles. However, it might not spring to mind when thinking of cities known for their architecture. That's not to say that it doesn't have good bricks and mortar, but when thinking of the UK, people's minds tend to drift to London. The Liverpool skyline boasts two cathedrals, the Space Age Catholic Metropolitan and the Gothic Anglican Cathedral, which is one of the largest in the world. There's also the Liver Building, with its copper birds watching over the River Mersey, the Radio City Tower, which shoots up through the city centre, beaming the breakfast show to rising Liverpudlians, and the red brick buildings at the Albert Dock, home to the Tate and several of the city's museums. These landmarks are surely contributing factors to the recent opening of the RIBA North, the Royal Institute of British Architects' new centre for architecture in the north of England.
The opportunity to have two different centres of excellence for architecture, one in the north and one in the south, is irresistible.
Jane Duncan is president of the RIBA and visiting the centre on its launch day.
Why did we choose Liverpool? I think it chose us, actually. And when we were offered this location, I don't think anybody could think of anywhere more fabulous. This location, for the public probably, is one of the best things that's ever happened to the RIBA, in my view.
The public's access to architecture is very much at the heart of the RIBA North's remit.
A lot of the general public don't really know what architects do. If you ask them, they probably know that we design buildings, but they have no idea, most of them, that we deliver buildings. We have to deal with planning, and we have to deal with context, and we have to deal with money, and we have to deal with legislation, and builders, and suppliers, and contracts, and it's a very, very complicated job. But the public don't know, so what an opportunity to tell them, to show them.
The grandest architecture, the scale of the city.
The centre boasts three gallery spaces, a cafe, shop and offices for the RIBA North and North West regional teams, as well as co-working space for others within the architectural industry. Over time, the galleries will play host to exhibitions about cities across the north of England. But the inaugural show, Liverpool, Mover, Shaker, Architectural Risk Taker, is all about its home city. Susie Jones is the newly appointed director of the RIBA North.
That was important to us, that the first exhibition was about Liverpool, because we're here and we really want the people of Liverpool to love this centre, whether they're engaging in architecture or not. So we saw that as a way of bringing in people who may not ordinarily engage in that sort of way with architecture. I'm incredibly passionate about this sort of activity taking place in the north, and that it has to. I think the north is more than just a direction, it's an identity. And I think that with our RBA North, what we're doing is we're recognising that architects in the north are operating in a different context to other parts of the country.
St George's Hall. If you arrive by train, you'll see that huge advertising.
The exhibition draws from the RIBA's vast collection of architectural drawings to present competition entries and student ideas for some of Liverpool's most famous buildings. Architecture historian Joseph Sharples is the curator.
Shops opposite the south end of the hall. Stuart Johnson Marshall again.
I can't put a figure on the number of works in the collection, but it is a huge collection. It's probably the greatest collection of architectural drawings in the world. But also these drawings have most of them have not been seen in public before, and some of them have been restored specially for this exhibition. So we're bringing works that are normally accessible to scholars in the search room of the RIBA. We're bringing them before a much wider public here.
The drawings include Gothic and Baroque designs for the Anglican Cathedral, intergalactic-looking ones for the Metropolitan, and department stores with space for people from the suburbs to fly in on personal aircraft to do a bit of shopping. And that one was dreamt up in the 1930s.
Obviously, a student is going to take a visionary approach to the future, and we'll have a lot of faith and confidence in new technology as a way forward. Nevertheless, it's a stimulating example of how you can approach the challenges of designing in a city.
This is a particular favourite of mine, this drawing of the panorama of the 1960s, part of the comprehensive replanning.
It's an imaginative exhibition that really prompts the viewer to re-examine how cities are designed. And Liverpool is a city that's undergone many facelifts. Off mic, I chat to Susie and Joseph about Liverpool's personality. It's a city that's always garnered a lot of flack over the years, but has never really sat back and taken it. Liverpool is a strong, resilient port city with an incredible history of industry and culture. Susie tells me that what she loves about it is that it never looks inward. It perches on the northwest coast facing the rest of the world. So how do you build for a city with such a strong sense of self? Joseph Sharples.
I think resilience is part of the character of the city. There's that sense in 19th century Liverpool that nothing was too difficult to overcome. And I think that's reflected in the design of buildings like the Albert Dock, for instance, in their colossal scale and their resilient materials of cast iron and granite and brick. And although circumstances have changed and we're not in the business of building docks in the city centre anymore, I do think those qualities of strength and resilience are fundamental to Liverpool architecture. And anything flimsy and insubstantial and temporary looking somehow seems out of place in Liverpool.
So what's the defining building of Liverpool for Joseph and Susie?
The defining building of Liverpool perhaps would be St George's Hall. For sheer scale and impact and ambition, I don't just mean architectural ambition, but cultural ambition. This was Liverpool in the middle of the 19th century, declaring that the wealth that had been pouring into it through trade could be used to express and to accommodate cultural aspirations. And such was the scale of that building that it stimulated the creation of other buildings dedicated to similar purposes all around it. So that's a key building in the development of Liverpool.
Personally, the Lewis's building, for me, really defines Liverpool. The Lewis's building is a department store. I used to come here every Christmas to see Father Christmas in Lewis's, and it's what you see when you come out of Lime Street. It was enormous when I was a child and full of wonder.
With the ability to spark both historical and personal stories, it's important that we look ahead to more great buildings. The RIBA North will be working closely with architecture schools and firms across the north of England. So what does Jane Duncan think of the future of architecture?
We have the most wonderful future. I'll tell you, we're in safe hands. What's going to happen to the buildings in the future? They're going to be brilliant.
While London has an abundance of architectural treasures, it's important that we look beyond our capital. Perhaps casting our gaze to the rich history of buildings in the north is a good place to start. For Monocle in Liverpool, I'm Holly Fisher.
Riba North is now open, and its inaugural exhibition, Liverpool, Mover, Shaker, Architectural Risk Taker, is on until the 16th of September. You can always find out more at architecture.com. Next, lighting luminaries don't come much bigger than Brescia-based Floss. Founded in the early 1960s, the company has produced some of the world's most iconic lamps, pendants and pieces from the likes of Philippe Starck and Michael Anastasiades. Floss's CEO, Piero Gandini, has been at the helm since 1999 and last week participated in a talk as part of the London Festival of Architecture. His contention? That as homes become smaller and housing denser in cities, outdoor space and illuminating it becomes a much more important priority. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Piero Gandini about Floss's latest collection and the company's future trajectory.
I personally don't consider Floss and Floss's history and my experience just a lighting experience. In reality, we are a design company. They decided to engage with the lighting things. You know, at the beginning, Floss was doing also accessories. Then they decided to focus on lighting. Our goal when we do products is, of course, to follow the update of the technology, the latest things, the technology. If you saw, our lighting world is changing the last years because of the LED revolution and all what that has given to us as chances to is really changing the shape and the size of things. So there is a total new horizon of vocabulary and shapes that can be created. And actually, we are participating, as you probably see, enormously in that game. But it's a little bit the same that happened when the halogen arrived or the fluorescent compact arrived. So we are different from who's doing chairs because the technological changes here are really impacting the production and loss. Light is going through incredible challenges in a beautiful way. I hope that the light industry will keep or will find the way to give new emotions and new sentiment and not become too technical, because this will be a pity.
One thing that you mentioned in your talk, and actually it's quite similar to the Monocle philosophy in a way as well, is that you don't do so much, you know, market research, you know, to see what your customer wants. You basically go with your gut feelings. Yes. And I think that's a very beautiful thing as well.
You know, I like people. I believe in people. So why not to follow the, you know, it's depending what you want to do. If in life your challenge is to become as big as possible, you have to turn the drive of a company into a marketing-oriented company. Difficult challenge anyway, but totally different horizon, totally different perspective. I grew up in a mission, like, you know, and be part of a cultural avant-garde process and find my inspiration and the people that use our product inspiration as a common goal. So, of course, we have to believe in what we think. There is an emotional part, a rational, of course, part. I want to say ethical part too in what we do, and we follow what we and our creative partners, like the designers we work with, we think, we believe. We never did a market survey in our life.
And I hope you continue like this as well.
Yeah,
and of course, here we're looking at your new outdoor space collection as well. And it's quite interesting because these days homes are becoming smaller and smaller. So in my opinion, I think outside spaces are becoming more important somehow as well. Would you agree with that? And do you think about that perhaps when you're designing the collection?
Designing outdoor collection, the first goal we had was we have to be able to produce the right technique, of course, but we don't want to annoy people with the technique. We don't want to be invasive, telling you, take our lamps because they are technically good. Of course they're technically good. Why, if they're not technically, why are you supposed to be there? So we don't care about it. We care about the relationship between the light and the object that we are doing with the nature, with the architecture, and with yourself. You know, I think when you are outdoor, perhaps it's a personal thing, but I don't believe it. When you are in an outdoor situation, your imagination is a little bit normally higher than the average. You know, you are in a beautiful sun, or you are in a beautiful moon, or there is an incredible horizon, or just one small beautiful flower. There is something, it's like your mind is out of the normal life stress, and you give you a second, can be a second, or can be an hour, or a kind of space for your imagination, romantic side. And this is important. You have to respect that. So you have to interact with this. You have to interact with the architecture. You have to interact with the nature. This is the strongest, at the same time, sweetest things out there. So that's the reason why we created Design You Saw out there.
Piero, I want to know more about your design process in your company. How much freedom do you give to your team as well to collaborate with your new pieces, for example?
We give a lot of freedom. If you want to take the best from somebody's vision, this guy has to be free. How can you ask somebody to share with you a strong vision he has and limiting his freedom? I don't understand. It's very difficult. What you can do is to organize sometime the process. Of course, when you do certain very specific functions, you have to give the support or certain guidelines or things like that. But in terms of freedom, a creative person, if he's not free, how can be creative? I don't understand, and not clear area there where I'm totally incapable to work. I want the courage, I want the vision, I want the skin, I want everything. I want the passion of myself, of my team, of the designer, of his team. All together, we have to feel like if we're saving the world that day. And this is the only way to really go strongly into an innovative process.
Piero Gandini there, CEO of lighting company Floss, speaking to Monocle's very own leading light, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, men's fashion season is in full swing as a coterie of well-dressed buyers hop between Milan and Paris and are next bound for New York. But as fashion weeks jostle for prominence and brands question the cost of catwalk shows, one fair has kept confident and been a bellwether for the menswear industry as a whole. Pitti Uomo wrapped up its 92nd edition in Florence last Friday and has affirmed its fans by remaining a space where small, independent brands can brush shoulder pads with the bigger boys. The addition of much-discussed big-name designers to the lineup has also helped attract those interested in the more avant-garde aspects of men's fashion. Monocle's very own Chiara Romella brings us this report from the Florentine Fair.
As seasons grow longer, in fashion terms, that is, many buyers need to be selective as to what shows and cities to add to their travel schedule. But none would ever think about skipping a stop-off in Florence for biannual fair Pitti Uomo. Every June, this appointment early in the season provides an opportunity to get a broad overview of what the next spring-summer season will hold. Many of the garishly dressed peacocks that flock to the central square may only be here to see and be seen. But for buyers, this trade show is time for serious business. 19,000 of them have come to the Renaissance Fortezza d'Abasso for this sweltering 92nd edition, from Germany to Greece, Korea to Canada. Many of them may not be placing orders just yet, but this remains a great time to scout for new brands that will appear on racks next summer. Yet, of course, according to what shop they work for, their strategy and approach to the show and its exhibitors changes dramatically. Céline Papon is a buyer at Milan's WP store in San Babila. Knowing she is buying for a concept store influences what brands she chooses, even more so now that the competition with online retailers is hotting up.
We opened our first concept store more than 30 years ago. And at that period, our art director, Andrea Cane, was actually going to US. I was a proper research, you know, go on the roots, try to find the brand and trying to traveling and really bring it back. You have less and less that because nowadays with the internet, everybody has a better access. And the hard part is really to find the unique product, to find the brand historical that nobody really knows now because internet makes everything go very, very quickly. So in our job, that's the reason why we change a little bit the way we buy. Before it was more focused on the product, now we're trying to mix the product, the storytelling, and also the outfit. So we went to creating, you know, taking a brand and buying nearly everything inside the brand to really focus, support the story of the brand, because that was important for us. Even in our store, I want to tell you, we were actually, for each brand we had, making small corner, writing their story. Before it was much more focused on the brand, now we're going more to interpretation, a mood, and it's changing very quickly too. As a buyer, I do name all the fashion fair. This is important because you never know what you're going to find and discover. It's important to find all suppliers or stylists, but also to look also for something new. And main-wise, I think PT, it's nowadays one of the most important fashion fair you have in the world, really. Because after you can find that in Paris, in several little fair like Capsule, Man, Trenoy, Liberty, but here, we are all here. And we are all fresh. We're not tired still. We all have a rest. We can start doing our appointment. So it's true that we don't always put numbers straight away because we are very curious to see exactly what it's going to be. So, you know, we take our time. But as the first one, it helps us to do a better job.
Next, I speak to Demir Azianoglu. Working as a buyer for Turkish department store Beymen means he not only has to think about the retail model he operates in, but also take into consideration the political shifts in his country and how they can affect people's willingness to shop.
We had very difficult times, as I'm talking about Turkey and Istanbul especially, since 2-3 years. You know, the terrorist attacks and everything, the increase of the exchange rates, the drop down of the tourist flow. You know, we have to be very flexible. Sometimes you are not placing an order or you have to cancel it just because of the, you know, foreseen trend of the tourist flow. So you are decreasing the budgets to be just to be unsafe. Then you try to be very, how to say, manage the business with the reorders and, you know, carry over things. It affects a lot. The environment that the country that we live is almost half of the business which is driven your business model. There is not so much country like in Turkey, like in Europe or in the world, like Turkey. It's very fragile. Now London is having this kind of problems and Paris had. And these all affects a lot the business. Actually, we have not so many, you know, real luxury department store chains in Turkey. There are a couple of. And all there continue to come to Pitti. Because life is going on. We have to kind of go on to survive. Turkish customers are really, they are really aware of the, you know, situation. Even in the difficult period of time, they kind of continue to spending. Some countries are like that, I think, the Lebanon or this kind of tricky regions. Life is always difficult. At the same time, you have to go on, you have to spend, you have to entertain yourself. So that's why everyone is coming.
And finally, as the founder of New York-based online shop No Man Walks Alone, Greg Lalouche has a whole another set of concerns to think about. Mainly, how to convey the tactile quality of the garments he finds here at Pitti to those who scroll through his well-designed website. He tells me more.
I think there's multiple dimension in way being online only affects how we buy and what we buy. I think the first one is, do we believe that we can tell the story of that product online in a way that's going to come through? And it can be anything from the particular texture of one of the fabrics or fabric selection to, you know, the details to, you know, what makes this item particularly unique and can someone actually see it if they don't have it in their hands? It doesn't mean we need to buy, like, you know, garish things that really, like, jump to your eye, but it also means that we unfortunately often have to stay away from things that just can't really be conveyed online. And also, I mean, presenting a product online for us is very different, I think, from a lot of online shops in that we're extremely detailed in how we describe the product, up to the grammage of the fabric and, you know, everything, the provenance, the visual aspect, how we can tell the story of the particular product. All of those come into the equation of what we buy and how we buy it. And then I would say the styling decision and how we present it is a little bit different online, because I think online everyone is doing a little bit their own selection rack. They are like browsing in their own particular way. Some people browse by maker. They want to see everything that that maker did. You know, it would be like going into a corner of a store and looking at that particular rack. Some people browse by color. They only really buy blue or black or gray. We kind of leave it a little bit up to the user. And then we do our own styling as well, and we prepare outfits and we shoot lookbooks and all those things to give our view of how this can be worn. But it's a little bit different than, you know, stepping into a store where the point of view is a little bit, it's a little bit more based on the outfit styling and a little bit less based on the items themselves. I think our point of view is about how things are made, who makes them, what makes those items great, and how you can, like, you know, work with them in multiple possible outfits. It's a little bit less about conveying a very specific styling direction to the user. The nature of our assortment and what we buy and what the product we like to sell makes it a very relevant and actually indispensable part of the buying season, because we try to find, you know, some of those smaller makers, the ones like smaller, more like craftsmen, artisans in Italy that do something really, really well, whether it's like a handmade shirt or like a particular accessory or a particular way to approach, you know, classic menswear items. And those guys, you know, they find, I guess, the time, the energy, and sometimes the budget to make it to Pitti. And when they make it to Pitti, sometimes they have a very small booth and they are able to, like, show their product to the world. But they don't travel the world. They don't go to Paris and New York and all those places. And so for us, that's an opportunity to see them, see what they're doing, and write the orders. I spent 3 full days at the fair, and I would say 2 full days spent on buying and writing orders and selecting from those makers that I only see here. And then thankfully I have a full day left to just open my eyes and see everything else.
Whatever the retail model or the stylistic preferences, buyers can find something that suits their purpose at Pitti. It is here, in this apparently relaxed chatting and ambling about in the scorching Florentine sun, that strategies for the year ahead really take shape. For Monocle, in Florence, I am Chiara Rimella.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and this show's erstwhile producer, Yolene Goffin. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to write our incoming producer, Ben Rylan, a note at br@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. Please do also leave us a review on the latter. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fenner. Until next time, thank you very much and goodbye.